I'm not sick.
Mercedes flushes slightly, and her eyes return to this world.
Lily, don't you want to have two good legs?
No.
Mercedes had not counted on this.
But, Lily, if you are blessed with a cure, it will be proof that God really does have a special plan for you.
I don't need proof.
Mercedes is vexed, for Lily is, of course, right. She requires no proof because she has faith. But the bishop requires proof. Rome requires proof. And Mercedes requires that Lily's goodness, the essential goodness of this family, be revealed for all to see.
Lily?
Mercedes lifts a lock of Lily's hair and slowly starts to wind and weave.
Do you know how pretty you are?
Lily begins her habit of sucking in her lips one at a time, passing them back and forth over her teeth.
I know you're afraid, Lily.
Lily's hair is so smooth, her honey cheeks tinted rose, her lips flushed and full.
Change is frightening, even when it's for the good. But, Lily, I also know that you love your family and that, in the end, you'll do what's best for everyone.
Mercedes strokes the long, gleaming braid and lets it fall. Lily remains still as Mercedes rises and takes her tea from the room. After a moment, Lily hears the piano and Mercedes' slender voice floating above it. Ave Maria. Like Londonderry air, or as Francis always called it, Londonderry air, many people find it impossible to hear this hymn and not swell with sweet guilt at how they ought to have been nicer to their parents while they still had the chance. But for some reason, it only makes Lily angry. Perhaps because she has always been so nice. Lily rises and leaves the kitchen, past the front room, Grazia Plena, where she can just see the top of Daddy's dry flaxen head above his parapet of books. She proceeds up the stairs, past the room where Francis has not stirred among moist sheets, and up to the attic to do the one thing she can for Francis. Lily is set to break the lock on the hope chest with her bare hands. She intends to remove the baptismal gown and dispose of it for good so that Francis never need come across it. But the hope chest isn't locked. The lid is down, but not quite flush to the frame of the box itself. Lily lifts the lid. The cedar smell wafts up, cloaking a second smell. In all likelihood, another mouse entombed and decomposing. What light there is reflects feebly from the yellowed satin of the old baptismal gown. Lily remembers the garment spread lightly over Francis's beloved dolls, not wrapped about them. But she must be mistaken, because when she slips her hands beneath and lifts, the gown feels full and heavy. Too heavy for dolls. Cool fur. Trixie. Swaddled and entwined.
Trixie!
She must have leaped in for a nap and the lid shut.
Oh, Trixie! Oh, no!
She must have panicked and tangled herself up, winding and twisting until she finally came to rest.
Poor Trixie!
Lily strokes the yellow eyes shut. But there is nothing to be done about the gaping jaw. A truly terrible smell now, the body having been disturbed. Lily takes the shallowest of breaths to avoid her gag reflex as she carries Trixie down the attic steps. On her way past Francis's room, she sees Mercedes by the dancing light of a candle, seated on the edge of Francis's bed with an empty tray in her lap. Lily continues down the front hall stairs. In Francis's room, Mercedes hears the kitchen door slam. She makes a move toward the window, but stops when she sees Francis coming awake at the sound.
Francis?
Francis looks up at Mercedes.
Francis, it's time to make you fresh and dry, dear.
Francis blinks. Mercedes smiles.
I've brought you your favorite dishes. Look.
Francis looks at the tray while Mercedes identifies its contents.
Blancmange, treacle, mead and mutton. It's empty. Francis?
Mercedes' head starts to shake. Mercedes, what's wrong? Mercedes' fingers begin a blind search of her own face, probing her eye sockets. Francis reaches up and gently lowers her hands. Mercedes takes a breath and pulls herself taut.
I'm sorry. I didn't want him to...
But trembles and cracks all over like spring breakup.
Die. I...
Francis reaches up and draws Mercedes down into an embrace, soaking them both. Mercedes smells the new milk.
I'm sorry, Francis. He died. It's not your fault.
Mercedes grieves into Francis's neck.
Maybe if we had stayed here and let Mrs. Lvovitz...
Hush! Patting her back.
Hush now. It's all right.
Mercedes mangles many words against Francis's neck, unintelligible to her sister but for...
I love you, Francis.
Shh.
Can I sleep here tonight?
But Francis is looking past Mercedes' shoulder out the window.
What's Lily doing?
Mercedes looks up. They can see Lily on her hands and knees in the garden. Somehow, she has rolled the big rock aside on her own. There is an object lying nearby, a brighter patch against the ground. Lily is scooping debris from a freshly excavated hole.
She's digging,
says Mercedes. They watch Lily pause and rest for a moment against the garden stone.
She's praying, says Francis.
They see Lily rise from her knees and pick up the dimly glittering bundle. She cradles it for a moment in her arms before lowering it into the hole. Mercedes rises and straightens her shoulders.
I'm worried about Lily, Francis.
Leave her be.
You know, Francis, one thing looks very much like another.
Mercedes.
What kind of a creature prefers to be crippled, Francis? Answer me that.
Mercedes has entered a mad classroom. I before E, except after C. The time has come, the walrus said, to give you 40 whacks instead.
Mercedes, come back.
But Mercedes has left the room, and now she is almost fainting at the evil smell enshrouding the hall. She follows the putrid cloud downstairs and into the darkened kitchen before Lily is halfway across the yard on her way back to the house. Mercedes waits with her hand on the electric light switch, trying not to breathe. One thing looks like another, but knows, knows. There is the odor of sanctity, and there is the stench of hell. The kitchen door opens and Lily steps into the sudden light.
What have you done?
Demands Mercedes. Lily's hands are cupped together around a secret. She looks like a child with a robin's egg.
It fell out of the nest. I rescued it, really and truly.
I've buried Trixie, Lily says. Mercedes waits, gives her one last chance. Lily walks to the kitchen table and deposits her treasure. Blackened with coal, nestled in a remnant of stained linen, a tiny human skull, fragile as a shell, with sutures still agape. Along with a few slender twig and pebble bones, the stuff of birds' nests.
And I've found my brother.
She watches as Mercedes gets down on her knees, squeezes shut her eyes, and in a stage whisper implores God to cast the devil from Lily. Exorcizo te, immunde spiritus, maledicte diabole. Repeating the words until they are no longer words, but sounds. She makes the sign of the cross over and over and over. Later, she will contact the bishop so that Lily may be taken away to a place where a special priest will drive the unclean spirit from her by force of prayer and perhaps other means, cruel to the body but so kind to the soul. Later, Mercedes will beg God's forgiveness for having flattered herself that she was the sister of a saint. Lily walks past Mercedes, whose mouth is twitching and hissing like a puncture, and into the front room. She is ready to ask James a question. She has already forgiven him for what she does not yet know. The reading lamp is on. She steps through a breach in his wall of books, to find him slumped as usual in the wing-back chair with his mouth half open. Dante's Paradiso has fallen from his hands. Lily picks it up and places it carefully in his lap. She bends and kisses his forehead. But she doesn't ask him the question, because he is dead. She returns to the hall, where Mercedes' whispers have risen to a buzz and whir. Lily mounts the stairs and walks into Francis's bedroom, full of the scent, the innocent passion of wildflowers.
"Francis, I've buried Trixie and said a prayer for her. I've found Ambrose."
Francis says, "Lily, reach up and hand me Wuthering Heights." Lily hands Francis the book.
"Remember when we buried the family tree?"
asks Francis with a small grin.
"It decayed," said Lily. "It was only made of paper."
"Did you find my nightgown?"
"A little piece of it."
Francis opens Wuthering Heights. The pages have been excavated in the center and replaced with a wad of cash. Francis hands Lily the money.
"Is this the Lord's money?"
"No, I earned it, honestly."
"Daddy is dead."
"I have a present for you, Lily. I was going to wait for your birthday, but I want you to have it tonight."
"What is it?"
"It's in the hope chest."
"Francis..."
"What's that sound?" Francis tilts her head to listen. "Do you hear that? It sounds like a swarm of..."
"It's Mercedes. I'm afraid of her."
"She thinks you're a saint."
"Not anymore."
"I know."
"I don't believe in the devil, Francis."
"Mercedes does."
"So?"
"I can't look after you anymore."
"It's okay, Francis. I can look after myself. I'm not scared of Mercedes."
"It's not just Mercedes. You have to go, Lily. Don't worry. I'll tell you where."
"No."
Francis cups Lily's face in her hands and looks her in the eyes. "Oh, yes." How can a person look into her own face and consent to be banished from it? For Lily, Francis is as first and familiar as the sky, as the palm of her own hand. The freckle on the nose, the green jewels in the eye, the smart mouth. What does it mean to be banished from the face that first looked you into existence?
"I don't want to leave you."
Lily's forehead buckles, but Francis insists. "You have to go. Little gingerbread boy, run away, and whatever you do, don't look back."
"This isn't a story, Francis."
Anger ignites Lily's grief. "Yes, it is, Lily."
"Hayola kelu bashelm." "It is not."
"Tai lahon habibti."
"No."
"Teberini."
"Stop it."
Francis reaches for Lily, but Lily flies into a rage, beating off the embrace until she forgets that Francis is not a book or a porcelain figurine. Francis doesn't move except to protect her face and breasts while Lily exhausts herself. When Lily crumples finally, The undertow gets a hold of her face and contorts it into a grieving clown. The same tide distends her voice.
I don't want to leave you, Frances.
The corners of Lily's mouth run with clear saliva. She is incapable of closing her mouth or of taking the next breath. Frances touches Lily's fist, unlocking her throat. The air pours, scraping in, and corrosive sobs begin. Come here, Lily. Frances opens her nightgown and guides Lily's mouth to drink. Shortly before dawn, Lily kneels before the open hope chest for the second time that night. She reaches deep down and withdraws a soft bundle wrapped in white tissue paper. She lifts out a beautiful flowing dress of pale green silk, then picks up the notebook that has fallen from its folds. Holy Angels Convent School. 10 minutes later, the shed door opens and Lily walks in. It is not necessary to search, for there it is, Daddy's project, finished. They are still mounted on the lasts, two bright red boots. The small one, perched on its built-up sole, smiles out at her, as does its big brother. Lily removes the new boots from their iron feet. She pulls them on, harnessing with care the left boot for its first taste of the bit. She wraps her ankles in the money Frances gave her, pulls tight the candy cane laces, and stands up. Calf leather. They enfold her feet like a second skin. No need to break them in. They go nicely with her beautiful new green silk dress. A little big for her, to be sure. And missing a sash, as you can see from the empty belt loops, but lovely all the same. With her notebook under her arm, Lily leaves the shed. The air is cool and moist with a hint of salt. The night is turning gray. It's the best time to see this town. Collieries, the tracks, the coal carts and company houses look best in the pewter dawn. Likewise, the ocean and the rocky shore. Farewell. Lily feels refreshed, as though she could walk forever. Farewell to Nova Scotia. She closes the door behind her and heads for the shore road. She looks back once and keeps walking.
Book 8, Hegira. 8 p.m., February 29th, 1918, New York City. Dear Diary, no, I will not use that form of address. That is a relic of childhood. This book will serve as a record of my progress as a singer. I will record only relevant facts which will prove useful as my training progresses. No gush. Let other girls record their crushes and their dresses, their tresses and trousseaus. I am here to work. I will note scientifically everything I learn as in a lab book. I will be objective and unflinchingly self-critical. I will not be distracted by the bustle of this city. And in this, my record book, I will not allow emotion to color my perceptions. 1:12 a.m. I am burning. I have to live. I have to sing. I want to transform myself into 1,000 different characters and carry their life with me onto the stage where it's so bright and so dark at the same time. Just knowing there are 3,000 people out there longing to be swept away by the passion that's about to flood out from scarlet curtains. To this I consecrate my body and my soul. I can give no more than all of myself. I feel my heart is a throbbing engine and my voice is the valve. Like a wailing train, it has to sing or blow up. There's too much fuel, too much fire. And what am I to do with this voice if I can't let it out? It's not just singing. I am here as a speck. But I don't feel scared or about to be blown away. I feel like all New York is a warm embrace just waiting to enfold me. I am in love, but not with a person. I am passionately in love with my life. Friday, March 1st, 1918. My voice teacher is someone I will simply call Herr Blutwurst. He is rude, and if my first lesson is any indication, utterly devoid of qualifications. I can only conclude he is a fraud. I will give him to week's end. He is a dry stick of a person. I feel dust in my throat just thinking about him. I was perfectly polite. He looked me over as though he were buying a horse. He has a horrible accent. He ordered me to zing something. I did, and he got an expression on his face as though he'd just ate a bad oyster. Why did it ever even occur to this man to enter any field remotely connected to music, since he obviously hates music? He said, after I had sung my Quanto Affetto, "We have a lot of work to do." I should have said, "Ich weiß das, Kassikopf. Das ist warum ich hier bin." He wants me to cry, but I won't. My daddy just finished killing a lot of his countrymen. My first advantage? I have everything. My second advantage? This is just another island. My third advantage? I am bigger than it all. March 2nd. I took a walk in Central Park. I didn't cry in front of Herr Kaiser. I didn't sing in front of Herr Kaiser, because he hates singers who sing. He claims to be Hungarian, but I know he's Fritzy. Why hasn't he been arrested? There's supposed to be a war on. Monday, March 4th. I ate the most delicious thing today. A pretzel. It's a baked thing tied in a knot. You eat it with mustard. Sounds unremarkable, but is brilliant. Wrote pointless surprise theory exam for Kaiser. Tuesday. Could someone please tell me what the point of hissing is? We have progressed, dear diary. I am now forbidden not only to sing, but to make any vocal sound whatsoever. Wednesday. Museum of Natural History with Giles and fossilized lady friend Miss Morris. Tea, then took me to see six girls doing modern dance in bedsheets, swishing knives around. Maybe I should be a dancer. Take that back about Miss Morris. They're both so nice, and I'm so bored. Thursday. Kaiser crept up behind me and put his skeleton hands around my lower back ribs and said, "For the purpose of these lessons, I must ask you to loosen or discard your corset." Filthy Bodekin. Friday, March 8th. Wearing my hair loose like Lady Godiva to feel less naked with no corset. Excellent feeling, though strange, like I'm always ready for bed or swimming. Came all the way to Island of Manhattan just to shed outmoded undergarment. Saturday. Got perfect on stupid fake theory exam. Killed him to admit that. "You have virtually perfect pitch, Miss Piper." There's no virtually about it, and he knows it. Asked him when I could sing again. He said, "As far as I can tell, Miss Piper, you have never sung in your life." Sunday. Giles asked if I wanted to come sightseeing. "No, thank you." Monday, March 11th. 8th Avenue elevated train, squashed like sardine. That which does not kill me only makes me stronger. Tuesday. My lower back is always aching. I have not cried. I'm past that. I'm numb. But I have almost fainted.
"Nein," he says. "Start again. Inhale, ja, und..."
And then I hiss. Wednesday. Oh, joy. Today I got to make a sound. With my mouth closed. I have no idea what he's talking about most of the time, and it isn't the language barrier.
think that you must hold a boiled egg in the back of your throat.
With or without the shell? Halfway through the lesson, as I was making a feeble little humming sound with my mouth closed, with my tongue in the N position while I was trying to put a smile into the sound, he said,
"That's it!"
Apparently, he has found the true placement of my voice. On the rear shelf of a disused library. Later. I wonder if anyone has ever committed suicide out of sheer boredom. Today, I was permitted to open my mouth ever so slightly and release the faintest of E's. Then he told me to put an A inside the E. Ah and ooh come after, but he wouldn't let me finish. He informed me that I had run out of air. I said I had plenty of air left, and he told me that perhaps I had air enough to sustain life, but not the note. I have to learn to sing on the breath, he said. Give me strength. Giles just called me for supper. Everything she cooks is white or light brown, except the boiled greens, which are gray. She said, in this voice that reminds me of dust on a doily,
"Before you know it, you'll have lots of friends, and it will seem like a different city."
I don't want friends. I didn't come here to make friends. She's nice, though. Why can't I just be grateful that there's at least someone who speaks kindly to me? Sometimes, though, she gives me a bit of the creeps. She'll look at me like she knows something, and then she'll say something completely innocuous. This whole apartment reeks of lavender. There are lace curtains and praying hands everywhere. It's like a fading photograph except for me. I keep seeing myself whirling around, breaking everything without even touching it. It makes me want to talk louder, breathe deeper, commit carnal acts. I look at myself naked. Yes, this is my confession. In the full-length mirror in the armoire in my room, I look at myself just to remind myself that I'm there. No, I look because I like to look, and that's how I know it's wrong. But how could it be? I feel an ache. I want someone to see me and touch me before I'm old, before it wrinkles and fades and falls. I can't believe that will ever happen to me. 14th. Intervals of seconds. Up and down and up and down and up and down and lasciatemi morir. 15th. Spent a month's car fare on a new dress. Pale green silk chiffon. Très chic, très moderne. I look about 25. I have no place to wear it. 16th. Intervals of thirds. Sunday, March 17th. No lesson today. No torture chamber. Also, I didn't have to get up at the crack of dawn to walk there on time, owing to the fact that I squandered a small fortune on that stupid dress I'll never wear. But oubliez all that. I am happy as a clam because I'm in Central Park all on my own. It's sunny. Life is long. I have all the time in the world, and I will sing. He has put my voice into a sad, solitary cell, but she will fly. I know, because I can feel her beating, getting stronger the longer she is silent. Could it be that the Kaiser's training is working? Or is it possible my voice is thriving on adversity? That is the perverse, unbreakable Piper spirit. Thank you, Daddy. There is a couple spooning in broad daylight not three steps away from me, in full view of a nanny and a six-year-old girl with a face full of freckles who keeps grinning at me. Reminds me of Francis. Little imp just whipped a rubber ball at me. It bounced off the bench. Now it's landed in the pond. Fish the ball out. Played like an idiot with her for the next hour and a half, much to nanny's relief. Après dîner. Because this is my diary, I will ask this question. Do you think Giles has ever been impure in thought and deed? Why do I have to think that about a perfectly innocent old lady? But no one is perfectly innocent. A good singer knows that. I am terrible. I don't care. I want to make love with my voice to 3,465 people at a time. Tuesday, 19th. I have been exiled to the mezza di voce, il passaggio. He calls it the no-man's land of the voice. It is another of his sadistic techniques. I am being held prisoner an octave and a half above middle C between E and G. Wednesday, 20th. He wants to ruin my voice. Friday. Il passaggio is abandoned. Il passaggio is all but silent. Il passaggio is another word for limbo. Saturday. I was late this morning. Couldn't get to sleep last night and couldn't wake up this morning. Herke worse than usual as a result. Monday, March 25th. It seems il passaggio is inhabited after all. Haunted is more like it, full of ghostly sighs and groans. 2 a.m. I dreamt of Pete. He was wearing Mama's apron and Daddy's pit boots, and he was crying and wanting me to hug him. There is no such thing. The lights are on now. No such thing as Pete. I want to go home. I want to see my daddy. Kathleen, grow up. 3:30 a.m. Don't write it down. I can't stop crying. What if there's someone outside my door? Oh, God. If I think about it, my door will open. Let nothing disturb you, nothing frighten you. All things are passing. St. Teresa, ora pro nobis. Thursday, 28th. Giles made me drink a special tea so I could sleep last night. It worked. Has she been spying on me? Friday. One heck of a middle C today. Felt like I was gorging on a chocolate eclair. Kaiser, none too pleased. After all, I'm a soprano. Sopranos don't sing in chocolate. Saturday. Today I cried. He told me to sing the C major scale. My first time allowed to put more than two notes together at a time. But still no consonants, just ah. I felt like I was climbing stone steps in the dark, and when I got a glimpse of light toward the top, I started crying, but I finished the ruddy scale. April Fool's Day. Today, Herr Nibs gives me that bloodless vulture eye, and no, he's more amphibian, he's probably covered in dry scales. Scales, ha-ha, from collar to cuff, and dines furtively on furry creatures thrice daily. I can just see the squirming lump making its way down his narrow throat. Does he regurgitate bones every evening? Well, today he says to me, I will accept you as a student, Miss Piper. Why didn't I say the perfect icy thing? I said, and I'm being completely honest here, so I'll tell you, I said, thank you, sir. May I be struck dead. Wednesday. Daddy sent me a book today, and Mercedes and Francis sent me saltwater taffy. I never thought I'd miss my little elves so much. I wish Daddy would put them in a special crate and mail them to me like kittens for a day or two. Thursday. La voix mixte. In every head tone, the resonance of the chest. In every chest tone, the rarity of the head. Ascend directly to heaven. Friday. Giles asked me to sing something for her this afternoon, and I had to say, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to sing anything but scales and arpeggios. The Kaiser says he can tell if I've been singing ditties on the sly. It's like I'm committing adultery with my voice or something. He's disgusting. Monday. He's making me wear my hair in a scalp-type bun. What does he think I am, a ballerina? Tuesday. I have had an epiphany. I now know what people mean when they say you have to suffer for your art. I always thought they meant rehearsing till you drop, performing when you're not in the mood, starving until you get discovered, and I always thought, great, I can't wait to suffer. But that's not it at all. The real suffering is this teacher trying to kill me with boredom by marching me up and down every scale known to man. Fine. I will beat him at his own game. I have begun repeating the entire morning's lessons 3 times every day. Wednesday.
Your vocal range is a freak of nature, Miss Piper. No more or less impressive than Mount Everest. It remains to be seen whether or not you have the stamina and skill to scale it.
Scale? Thursday. I love the buildings. They're called skyscrapers. They're the closest thing to an ocean here. But it's an ocean that goes straight up, not flat out. They say that the body of water stretching away to the east of Manhattan is the ocean, but it isn't. Not my ocean, anyway. It's weird, because back home, I just took it for granted, my gray-green sea. Now I have a granite ocean. It gives me the same happy-sad feeling I need sometimes. When I look straight up at the buildings, I can feel alone in a good way. Not in that horrible way of no one knows me. Friday. This is not a city. This is a world with whole countries in it. You could go mad here if you were the type of person who thought you were sane in the first place. I have found something past the granite ocean. It's a whole amazing world. You can walk for an hour and never hear a word of English. You can eat in 5 different countries in 5 blocks. You can hear music everywhere. Why am I studying? Why do I want to be caged on a stage when the real singers are out here, singing about fish, hollering out rhythm across wheelbarrows full of fruit to the timpani of Tin Pan Alley, a chorus of trams, horseshoes, knives, and live animals? This is where the opera is. The Met is a mausoleum. The music room is a funeral parlor. God, I don't want to wind up in a museum. Monday. There are places in Central Park that are better left unexplored, and I won't scandalize you by telling you why. Tuesday, April 16th. Coney Island. Ate only pink things. Threw up. It was worth it. Wednesday. Start at the South Street docks. Halifax times 20. They better hope it never blows up. I see horses being winched up by their bellies and slings onto ships. They've been conscripted. That's what most of the ships are for. New York feeds the war. New York goes to the whole world, and the whole world comes to New York. I love seeing huge crates with Chinese writing swing through the air and pile up on the dock alongside every other language known to man. I'd like to spend a whole day just watching the men in the cargo, but I can't linger too long, because of all the tough customers wondering what a nice girl like me is doing, etc. What would they do if I said, "Hey, pal, I think you're beautiful. You move like Nijinsky. You're my idea of a Greek god in overalls." But I'm not allowed to say anything at all, because they'd think I was asking for it. Men get to chat to strangers and learn all kinds of things. Women get to take a book out of the library. When I am a famous singer, I will talk to whomever I please. On foot up through the Bowery, the Italian Quarter, kids, carts, food, women in black, good-looking guys, but don't let them see you looking. Opera Verismo. Greenwich Village, ladies and gentlemen. Tenderloin, get hungry here, buy a pretzel, have lunch in Hell's Kitchen. Really? Why do they call it that? Seems perfectly nice. In fact, you can have a free lunch at Devlin's Saloon Bar.
It's true. A sign said ladies' entrance, so I entered. And there were a whole bunch of women with red faces and gristly elbows. And all you have to do is pay a nickel for a beer that comes with a hot heaping plate.
Up Broadway, a bit tipsy.
Not used to beer. The Golden Mile. Union Square, Madison Square, Herald Square, past the Met. Genuflect. Promenade through Times Square, Columbus Circle.
Buy popcorn for the pigeons to keep them in the statue business,
where they perform a valuable civic service by keeping the glorious past in perspective.
Into the park. Zigzag through that immense chunk of countryside smack in the middle of the greatest show on earth.
Past the pond, the lake, the castle.
Skip the reservoir. It's too big and too small.
Promise to go to the Metropolitan Museum next time.
Harlem Mere.
Sit down and decide I've walked far enough.
Out onto Central Park North, up Lenox 37 blocks to the Harlem River.
It's night.
Take the 8th Avenue elevated back, dead happy tired with the whole city around my head like a halo. There are no Dutch people in Harlem. I have noticed on walks that colored people and foreigners in general are totally different here. In New York, it's not like they're in someone else's city. At least, not in their own neighborhoods. The neighborhoods are whole cities themselves. At home, when I passed by the pier or 14 Yard, I always felt sorry and thought how lucky I was not to be born into that. But here, when I went into Harlem, I felt weird for being white. It's full of churches and families just out strolling in the evening. I felt conspicuous. But I never fit in down home either, so what's the difference? Everything in New York is a photograph. All the things that are supposed to be dirty or rough or unrefined are the most beautiful things. Garbage cans at the ends of alleyways look like they've been up all night talking with each other. Doorways with peeling paint look like the wise lines around an old feller's eyes. I stop and stare, but can't stay, because men always think I'm selling something, or worse, giving something away. I wish I could be invisible. Or at least I wish I didn't look like someone they want to look at. They stop being part of the picture. They get up from their chess game and come out of the frame at me, blocking my view. What do they see when they look at me? Friday, April 19th. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Last night I snuck out at midnight when Giles was asleep.
Why didn't I do this weeks ago?
I thought there was music during the day, but the night consists of nothing but. The problem is I can't get into any of the interesting-looking places unescorted. But so far, it's enough to drink up the night, the street lights, the life on front stoops off Broadway, behind curtain windows, private clubs with shuttered doors, the faint sound of trumpets and drums, and the longest automobiles I have ever seen. I thought Harlem would be asleep by the time I got there, considering the number of churches, but maybe the churches turn into clubs at night, like toys coming alive 'cause it was a different city. On the main streets, anyhow. Daddy always says that in Ireland the number of churches is exceeded only by the number of pubs. Lenox Avenue was gorged with people dressed to the nines, lines of limousines, a fair number of white people, even mixed couples pouring in and out of places. It whitens somewhat at night. I'm on the verge of answering the next man who says, "Hey, sweetheart, where's your boyfriend?" just so I can step inside somewhere, anywhere, so long as there's music, music, music. I did go to one place, though. Jerry Chan's Chop Suey House at Canal and Bowery. Delicious. Here's my fortune. You will meet a tall, dark, and handsome stranger. Très romantique, n'est-ce pas? Tuesday. Today the Kaiser made me stand barefoot in a basin of ice water while vocalizing. Friday. This morning he brought out the Vakai practical method of Italian singing. I could have wept to see my childhood friend. I never thought I would be so happy to start at the beginning all over again. How the mighty have fallen. Kaiser opened to page 1. The scale. At least it set to words and said, "Vals only, if you please." I told him I can read Italian, but he ignored me. So, it is still not yet given to me to chew solid food. No consonants. I plot his death. Have an accompanist now. She is a machine he imported to plod through the vocai while I gum the vowels. Why bother? And he has the nerve to tell me to pay attention to the music she is plunking out. Saturday. I can tell when a piano is out of tune, and yes, it does matter. Monday. Why am I wasting my time and anyone else's? I can't sing. Forget how. Forget why I ever wanted to. Giles says I look pale. Good. I'm staying in bed tomorrow. Wednesday, May 1st. The Kaiser went nuts when I came in today.
Where in God's name have you been?
I was sick.
I don't care if you come here spitting blood, you will come. Next time you are indisposed, I had better learn of it via your obituary in the papers. Do you understand me?
Ja, mein Kaiser.
He'd said he'd fling me out if I missed another class.
I didn't say, "Ja, mein Kaiser." I said, "I'm sorry, sir." Then I thought, what the heck? He's already wild at me. So I added, "Sir, I didn't think one day more or less of scales would be any grievous loss to the music world." And he slapped me. I looked over at the accompanist. That girl is made of stone. She didn't look at me. She just waited for him to give me the command.
E minor, Miss Lacroix?
And she started in like a player piano you couldn't give away. I sang, but I don't know where it came from. If I told my father, he would come and kill this man. Why didn't I hit him back? The strange thing is, today I felt like I was singing those ruddy scales for the first time. I can't explain it. It wasn't in words. It was this knowledge, all of a sudden, as though I knew it all along, but didn't know I knew it. And it was. All the music is in this scale. The scale is just a safe place where all the music can fold itself down and get stored. Like seeds. And the scale sounded so pure to me. Like in the end, if you had to be stranded on a desert island, you wouldn't take Traviata or Bohème. You'd take one scale. Because it has everything in it. I hope I don't have to be whacked every time just to learn one crummy, measly, huge lesson. Thursday, May 2nd. Singing words! Saturday. He asked me today if I knew the difference between sentiment and emotion. Monday. Today, he said,
"Your voice is a beautiful face, which you manipulate with the coarseness of a circus clown."
My first compliment from the Kaiser. Thursday, May 9th. The Kaiser has set up an audition for me with Mr. Gatti Casazza, il numero uno of the Metropolitan Opera. November 12th. He is going to let me sing an aria.
Aria? What's that?
The Kaiser said if I'm lucky, Mr. G.C. will put me in the Met chorus next season. And I finally got up the guts to say I'd rather go back to New Waterford and have 10 babies than tote notes in the Met chorus behind some Franklin stove of a superannuated diva. No, diary. I must be honest. I said, "Sir, I am not chorus material."
And he said,
That is the correct answer, Miss Piper.
Saturday.
Listen to the piano. You're not listening, Miss Piper.
I'm sick of the piano. It's time the piano started listening to the voice. Monday. I asked the accompanist, perfectly politely, how long she had been playing piano, and she raised one eyebrow and said, I've always played. Oh, allow me to prostrate myself before thee, O Sphinx of the keyboard. Tuesday. Miss Lacroix is in league with the Kaiser. She can do no wrong. She plays like an automaton, and I'm supposed to follow her. I told the Kaiser, I might as well go down to the Henry Ford plant and sing to the rhythm of the assembly line. I said exactly that, and he just shrugged a bit. Maybe he's mellowing. Maybe I'm wearing him down a little, or maybe, oh, horrors, he likes me. She still never looks at me, much less says good morning. Who does she think she is? Where did he dig her up? I thought colored people were supposed to have rhythm. Friday. She has a first name. Rose. If you could meet her, you'd know how unlikely that is. And what's more, she can actually play the piano. I came early today. I saw the Kaiser chatting with his most terrible majesty, Signor Gattacazazza, out front, and I slipped by and up the stairs. That's when I heard the most sublime, the most beautiful music. I thought it was Chopin at first. It was that romantic and thoughtful. But I knew it wasn't quite that. Then I thought Debussy. It was dreamy enough, but there was too much space in between some notes, and not enough time between others, and time changes that slipped by before you could pinpoint them, and sudden catches of achingly sweet melody that would just end like a bridge in midair or turn into something else. And though there were many melodies, you could never hum the whole thing, nor could you figure out how they could all belong in the same piece, and yet somehow they do, and you have no idea how or when it should end. In fact, it doesn't end. It stops. Some modern composer, I guess. Anyway, it was her playing, the sourpuss accompanist. She didn't see me. Someone should do something about her clothes. She dresses in pink, with puffed sleeves, pleated skirts, and a hemline 1 inch above the ankle. Looks like she just came out of church around 20 years ago. Hand-me-downs, maybe. From some rich battle-axe in the Temperance League. Anyhow, when she stopped playing, I said, "That was nice. Who wrote it?" And she just glared at me. If looks could kill. Just then the Kaiser came in, so our delightful conversation was cut short. He said as usual, "Let's start with C major, Miss Lacroix." And you'd never know she was a musician. But I know. Wednesday. Miss Lacroix and I have a game we play. It's called Kathleen Arrives Before the Kaiser and Listens to Miss Lacroix Play Piano, who pretends not to know Miss Piper is there. Why are the only people I've met in this city either senile, sadistic, or eccentric? Thursday. After listening to Miss Lacroix play in the mornings before class, I feel like a total imposter with no musicianship. She'd love to know that. I have figured out one of her secrets. She is the composer of the beautiful strange music she plays. If she even composes it, I think she just makes it up as she goes along, because her pieces always come to an end the moment before I hear the street door open downstairs, which means she has seen the Kaiser through the window. Saturday. This morning I got there even earlier and broke the Kaiser's rules. I sang whatever I darn well pleased. I sang Tosca.
I felt like a criminal or a nymphomaniac. And when Miss Lacroix arrived, I was dying to see the look on her face when she discovered she'd been beaten at her own game. But I didn't want to acknowledge her presence any more than she does mine. She left. And I could have killed her, except I suspect she just went out into the hall to listen, not wanting to give me the satisfaction of an audience.
Friday, May 31st. Goddard. This morning I came to the end of Let the Bright Seraphim. Then I got up silently and crept to the door, and there was Rose, sitting on a chair tilted against the wall with her eyes closed. Her profile is imposing. I wish I could draw it. She is arrogant even with her eyes closed. Especially with her eyes closed. She has a tall, round forehead and a high, straight nose that flares out at the base of the nostrils, and her lips sit against each other like dark pillows. Almost purple. The only way my lips could remotely look like that would be if I puckered up for a kiss. But she doesn't look like she's expecting anyone to kiss her. Her eyes go up slightly at the outside corners, almost as if she were Oriental. She has high cheekbones and a dimple in her chin, which is entirely wasted on her, dimples being accessories to girlish charm. She reminds me of the pictures of African women on P.T. Barnum posters, except she hasn't got the rings around her neck. And she's not wearing a colorful turban. She has her hair pasted to her head in two pigtails with little ribbons that look utterly perverse on her. Not to mention her Pollyanna dress with the ruffles. Doesn't she have a mother? Or a mirror? I noticed all this in the 3 seconds before she opened her eyes and looked at me. She didn't say a word. Just got up and went into the studio and started playing. Scales. Then she spoke, and I should have slugged her. She said, without even looking at me, "You embellish too much. That's a thing of the past." Have I mentioned she's 5'10"? 2:30 a.m. The Harlem Rhythm Hounds. But the sun is coming up. Good night. Saturday. Can you wail like that saxophone? Can you walk like that bass guitar? Can you talk like the trumpet and beat like the drum? Then what are you doing so far from home, little girl? Monday, the 3rd. David is too embarrassed to dance, but there are lots of fellows willing to dance with me, and I feel perfectly safe doing so because, after all, I have an escort. He was scandalized when I danced with a colored man named Nico, but he got over it as well he should. I fail to see why color should cause such a commotion. I wonder if there's anything like this going on back in the Pier or 14 Yard. I was too much of a press then to find out. Tomorrow night, David's taking me to the Ziegfeld Follies. Maybe I'll introduce him to Giles. Tuesday. I want to be a showgirl. I'm going to take tap dancing lessons, forget the opera. I think this is an enchanted city where you hear with different ears and see with different eyes. I feel like I've been living in a graveyard till now, reading dead books, listening to dead music, singing dead songs about dying. Beautiful, yes, but dead. Like Snow White in her glass coffin. Except the music I've been singing doesn't move when you kiss it. Or, at least, if it could. I haven't found out how to make it. Wednesday. I am so irresponsible, dear diary. How could I not tell you who David is? He's my soldier. He said, "Excuse me, miss, is this seat taken?" He's 19, and he's on his way to the front. He is so debonair. At least, his uniform is. To listen to, he's very sweet.
He's a farmer, and his father is angry at him for enlisting, but he's determined. He wants to live a little before getting hitched to a plow for life, and who can blame him?
I met him at Chan's, where I go to read and eat something that goes crunch. David is tall and quite nice-looking, but I don't think he could be the one from my fortune cookie because his hair is sandy and his eyes are blue. Anyhow, we must have gone to 15 clubs, and we ended up at a place that was half theater, half bar, called Club Mecca. It's up in Harlem on 7th Avenue, and I had to drag my soldier in there. And that's where I heard jazz. How can I describe it? I heard my mother play ragtime at home, but jazz is something else. Friday, June 7th. Sweet Jessie Hogan is a singer. I am not a singer. Sunday. Had David over to meet Giles. He liked her, ate everything on his plate. She showed him a decrepit photo album, a gallery of spinsters. And either he's a great actor, or he was actually interested. Tuesday. Jazz. Wednesday. Razzmatazz. Thursday. I can truck. I can ball the jack. I may be crazy, but I ain't no fool, so rock me in the cradle of love. Friday, June 14th. A riddle. How can I be singing scales for the Kaiser on the Upper West Side, while several blocks northeast of here, Sweet Jessie Hogan, the diva of Club Mecca, is sleeping off last night's jazz? Has Miss Hogan ever sung scales? Would she put up with this? Saturday. She sings like 12 saxophones and a freight train. She wears about a pound of gold. The band just tries to keep up with her. She's no lady. Her songs are all unbelievably unhappy or lewd. It's called blues. She sings about sore feet, sexual relations, baked goods, killing your lover, being broke, men called daddy, women who dress like men, working, praying for rain, jail and trains, whiskey and morphine. She tells stories between verses, and everyone in the place shouts out how true it all is. Imagine. The more interruptions, the higher the praise. Like a real chorus. Picture Sweet Jessie Hogan at the Met. The best opera is just high-tone blues. Sunday. David said, what if he gets killed in the war? He doesn't want to die, never knowing what love is. Translation, he doesn't want to die a virgin. I don't believe he was a virgin, but I was. But that's all taken care of now. I don't want any fella thinking he's got anything special to teach me. And besides, David is nice. We got a room for 2 hours. He said we were newlyweds, but the man at the desk looked like he didn't care. Well, I liked the kissing part, and the next part, and I didn't mind the rest too much, but he seemed more... Well, he went to the moon, and I stayed here on Earth, and he looked totally overcome, like a sweet, stupid puppy, and said, I love you. I felt like we'd just been to 2 different moving pictures and didn't know it. Tuesday.
Do not pretend to things that are outside of your experience, Miss Piper. If you have never suffered, do not manufacture an imitation of suffering. If you have never been in love, do not insult your listeners with cloying counterfeit.
Wednesday.